Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderford.
It's Monday, August 5th from HBR2. It's The Conversation. Coming up today, clearing debris through the DOE for better mental health.
And clearing ocean debris for better marine health.
Clearing the air over sweatbox classrooms.
And clearing the floor with Maui swing dancing.
Plus the world view from Deutsche Welle, back to school in the backyard, and a UH beep with no strings attached in today's reality check.
Support for NPR comes from Zurich Insurance, providing risk management and insurance solutions to help businesses meet their ever-changing needs. Learn more at zurichna.com.
Good morning. This is The Conversation on HPR2. Good morning, Beth Ann. I think we both come in early enough to beat the traffic, but not everybody did today.
Well, a lot of people listening now no doubt are caught in some of it or feeling the after effects of they've gotten up and
school's
out.
In.
School's in, and that's what we're focusing on this morning because it is the first day of school in Hawaii, and for a lot of kids and their families, there's no joy in Hulaville. Instead of new clothes, backpacks, and supplies, frustration, lack of services, and heartache will start and stay this school year. Many parents of special needs children will face rhetoric and inaction while each day their kids get a little older. That's according to Matthew Bassett, the litigation director for the Hawaii Disability Rights Center, on the phone with us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I'm here.
Thanks so much for joining us. This school year has some differences for kids who will be facing some different core curriculum standards or common core standards, but this doesn't apply in any way to what's been happening with kids who have special needs, does it?
No, it doesn't. And with students with special needs, they have an IEP, that is an individualized education program. They may not even be subject to the core curriculum standards if they're on a certificate-bound route, which is encouraged in a lot of students who are not showing adequate progress. Rather than dealing with providing appropriate interventions, they will just eliminate the standards and allow them to continue through without showing progress on their educational standards.
It's been a while since the Felix Consent Decree was met, and for a lot of parents who talk to us, they say that things now still are much worse than they had hoped for.
Well, that's pretty much true. I actually worked on the Felix Consent with Mr. Sykes and Shelby Floyd. Our agency represented an individual that was named in that program and allowed us to designate an attorney to attend meetings and go to the court proceedings. So I, review the documents and so forth. But one thing about the consent decree, it required the state to maintain a continuum of placements for mental health students. And it was a mental health lawsuit. What has happened is the state has not maintained a continuum of educational placements for students with mental health needs. And in my practice, working with students with mental health requirements, generally if it's a high-end student, they wind up in the mainland into a residential program because there are no residential programs here. There are no day treatment programs. There are no facilities for dealing with kids with high-end mental health needs. So the state has basically farmed out some of that responsibility to some nonprofits, but their capacity is very, very low. It's very minimal. And
so when you say the capacity is low, specifically what? What capacity do we really have right now today as we're starting this school year?
Well, I would say the capacity is basically zero. You have a school like the Trumpet school system, which handles students in the dozens of students, but we have a need for hundreds of students for services. And there's just no money allocated for a day treatment for kids with high-end needs. Essentially, you know, grade schools, middle schools, high schools are not built to deal with students with high mental health needs. They don't have the personnel or the capacity. And because of budgetary limitations, they are required. Basically, well, the superintendent controls the budget on these matters and tells the principals that they are not allowed to, at least here on Maui, that they're not allowed to make any placements other than public school placements, no matter what the public what the mental health needs are of the student.
Doesn't that put them in violation?
It is a violation, yes. It's up to the IEP team, the principal, and the teachers to decide what are the services to be provided. And here, those are controlled by the district level. And so that kind of, it's kind of a corruption of the law leads to some serious consequences regarding students who require these mental health services.
Given everything that you've just said, how likely is it that this situation is going to change anytime soon?
Very unlikely. It's ingrained in the system of these kind of problems. It starts off really with the superintendent being picked by the governor. Mattioli, she's a very nice person. As an attorney, has absolutely no idea how to run a school system. You know, right now, the systemic problems with the Hawaii school systems and our rankings as far as, you know, nationally are terrible. And Mattioli's solution to that is just to eliminate standards for all the high schools. You actually have to...
Okay, but come back somewhere. So
right.
We're running out of time a little bit, Matthew, and I want to get back to the issue of special needs kids.
Yes.
So really, if not a lot is being done for them, not a lot that you can see is coming down the pike, is this sort of the de facto strategy that parents are going to have to adopt to simply remove their children or go elsewhere, and doesn't that serve the needs of the DOE in a way too?
That happens in a lot of situations. I really advise parents, don't do this alone, that you have to, that if you have student with a child with special needs, get an advocate or an attorney to help you. If they require expensive services, you're not going to get it from the school unless you bring a advocate with you to your IEP meetings, or that you have an attorney to help you get those services with your using the procedural safeguards that are in the IDEA.
Which sounds as if you have to create an adversarial situation to get anything done.
Yeah, it is going to be somewhat adversarial because, the school is set up not to provide services, and so you have to fight for that and use your due process procedural safeguard, or at least put enough pressure on the school to get those services. And even if you prevail locally, you're going to have a hard time finding a school that can provide high-end services. You're going to wind up on the mainland for a while at a residential program in Oregon or California or someplace else. And so that's
Matthew, this is not sounding good for a lot of parents who had, you know, great hope even in the wake of Felix. But as you've mentioned, things have not been going well. We can hope all we want, but the bottom line of it is that you're going to have to fight for your kid, and that may mean taking the fight long and hard and an expensive one, too. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Matthew Bassett is the litigation director for Hawaii Disability Rights Center, formerly the Protection and Advocacy Agency of the State of Hawaii. He has a history with that agency. He's worked for it since 1997, and the focus of his practice continues to be special education.
Support for The Conversation comes from the BIA Remodel It Right, Remodel It Green Expo, featuring exhibitors and seminars on planning a remodeling project, remodeling for aging in place, and sustainable design and construction, this Friday through Sunday at the Blaisdell Exhibition Hall, biahawaii.org.
What Vietnam taught us all about war. There was not a willingness to acknowledge that war damaged people, that there was this effect that society had to deal with.
Voices of War's Hidden Damage, Post-Traumatic Stress and the Legacy of Two Wars in America. We begin a week-long series next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. This half hour, snacking on fish who've been snacking on maritime garbage and researching a potential researcher in the reality check. First, back to the backyard schoolyard.
Umurokai, ulana, umau, ukaholabe, uhavai.
School's back in session today, and that includes Benjamin Parker Elementary School in Kaneohe. It's named for the Reverend Henry H. Parker's father, Benjamin, not Spider-Man's uncle. The school opened in 1927 on a 5.5-acre site bequeathed to the territory of Hawaii by Reverend Parker to honor Henry's father, Benjamin, also a minister. The elder Reverend Parker arrived on Oahu in 1833 with the 6th Company of Missionaries. He founded a mission school for Hawaiian children 2 years later on land granted him in Kaneohe by High Chiefess Liliha. The younger Reverend Parker became the pastor of Kauai Hau Church in 1863. The land he gave back to Hawaii became the site of the first public school on the Windward Side. In fact, by 1940, Benjamin Parker served grades kindergarten through 12 with over 1,400 students. But by 1951, it was an elementary school once again. So our question today is, whatever happened to Benjamin Parker High? Don't cut class. We'll tell you the answer later in the show.
I love coffee, I love tea, I love the Java Jive and it loves me. Coffee and tea and the Java and me, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup.
Each Monday, we take the pulse of Java sippers at various coffee shops around the island. Today, as many folks are heading into the city, Bill Sage is in Wahiawa at Green World Farms. Morning, Bill. What's brewing?
Good morning, Beth Ann. Right now, we're brewing, and I saw a sign saying, perk 'em up. I saw a sign saying, it's every coffee shop sign in the world, but it's actually Green World Farms. And today, there's a gentleman who's interested in GMOs. He calls himself a deviled advocate. His name is Jacob. Jacob, good morning. What's brewing in your mind?
Oh, I don't know. I go from house to house, friend to friend, and everyone's trying to be healthy and purchasing all these really expensive organic foods, and I'm really supportive of their dieting. It's just no one really knows what they're doing or what really GMOs are trying to do. And it's getting kind of snobbish. And I don't like it anymore. So I've decided to take the opposite side and go for GMOs because, I don't know, I feel like the issue of world hunger is more significant than an individual's health. Because, like, my grandparents smoked, drank, chew tobacco, probably did all the worst things that, you know, you could do for your body, live to a healthy age of 75. There's still people who do the opposite and live the healthy way, live to 74. So I don't know how bad these GMOs are for you. Maybe the preservatives are preserving your life. I don't know. But I think we should probably do a little bit more research and not be so organic crazy. I saw a sign the other day for an organic vacation rental, and I don't know what that means as far as organic vacation rental.
When you say that GMOs, so far you might have had some and you don't think they've affected you, right?
You know, I'm speaking a little fast. I can't tell if that's the coffee or maybe all the preservatives from all the GMOs, but I don't know. No, I would say I don't know if they affected me.
Okay, but so far you look young and healthy, and you live out here in the Wahiawa area.
No, I live in the North Shore. I work out in the Wahiawa area. This Green World Farms, not in the town, but out in the triangle as you come to that weird intersection that takes you to Schofield or the North Shore or wherever you're going.
Do they have do they sell GMO coffees out here, and how do they sell them?
No, we do not use GMOs. All these coffees, I'm pretty sure, are organic. I'm not the farmer. I'm just a barista who makes the coffee.
Okay, well, Jacob, thanks for talking with us. You look young and healthy, and so far you don't seem like you've had your genes too heavily altered. So I think we'll be coming out here, have another cup, and if I'm not too altered, I'll be back next week at Cocoa in Waikiki. So keep sipping and keep thinking, and we'll keep you informed of what's brewing around the island. Back to the studio. Aloha.
Earlier this morning, we talked about an unhealthy situation for some of Hawaii's students. Now we'll look at the toxicity that surrounds all of us, literally. It's hard to look at photographic evidence of marine debris in our oceans without a queasy feeling, and perhaps an unanswered question about how much potentially toxic material ends up on our dinner tables. Anela Choi, a UH Manoa graduate student, has put that question at the center of a new research project and has come up with some troubling findings. She's with us in CR7. Good morning, Anela.
Good morning, Chris, and good morning, Beth Ann.
You know, we've been hearing about marine debris for quite some time, and, you know, logic would indicate that the smaller fish who eat marine debris are going to get eaten by larger fish.
Yes.
And it's very unscientific logic. This is a civilian talking, right?
Still good logic.
But the bigger fish are going to eat the smaller fish, and they ate some things they shouldn't have. And who's to say we're not going to end up with some of that material, right?
Right. What you're talking about is more of a direct ingestion. So a prey fish eats a piece of plastic, for example, mm-hmm. and a larger fish eats that prey fish and that little piece of plastic. Mm-hmm. And then when the prey fish digests, the plastic is likely to remain in the stomach of the fish.
Some of the chemical material is going to remain in the fish, very likely, yeah.
It's possible, yes, but it's not known yet whether or not that happens. The chemical transfer of these different toxins that are found in plastics, it hasn't been shown in any experimental or observational ways, at least in large marine fishes.
So intuitively, it seems as if it might happen, but we don't have the evidence in. Is that right?
Correct. Yes. But it's interesting to note that, you see marine debris in seabirds, marine seabirds a lot, and they often have stomachs just overflowing with debris.
Yeah.
And I think in an experimental setting, it has been shown that, at least in seabirds, things like PCBs, if you feed a seabird diet with elevated PCBs, mm-hmm. Their chicks are found to have slightly elevated levels, mm-hmm. but that's seabirds, and it's still a big growing area of research.
And this is the kind of thing where in science it's irresponsible to say anything more than this is highly suggestive, maybe.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
I guess what's interesting to me, Anela, is that considering the amount of concern we have about the quality of our food these days, and we just had a discussion of GMOs a minute ago. Even with all that, there are a lot of things that you would think would be vital that haven't been studied yet, right?
Correct. And the fish that we were looking at are large open ocean predatory fish, so they have the ability to swim really long distances. They can also dive really deep down into the ocean, mm-hmm. Hundreds of feet down. And the fact that they're living in, the biggest planet on the biggest habitat on the planet.
Yeah.
It's really understudied.
And the fact that the habitat is as corrupted as it is by marine debris. I mean, there's just vast areas of it out there.
Yes. So, yeah, and it's interesting because the fact that we are finding plastic in the stomachs of these large marine fishes, it kind of brought a new angle to the marine debris issue because, marine debris is typically thought of as a surface issue.
Mm-hmm.
You see it floating on the surface of the ocean, but these are, like I said, large fish that actually live. We think they live deeper in the water column and swim and forage there. And the fact that they're ingesting marine debris suggests that it's not just a surface level problem.
Sure.
Yeah.
Let's just set the stage briefly, Anela. What were the fish that you studied?
We looked at 10 species of open ocean fish. They ranged from things like the broadbill swordfish to different types of tunas, big eye, yellowfin, skipjack, and then some fish that live deeper in the water, call them OPA, escalar, things like that.
Many of these being fish we considered extremely good eaten, right?
Many of them. Mm-hmm. But it was actually good news because the fish that we eat most commonly actually had the lowest levels of debris ingestion. The three fish that had the highest levels were lancetfish, which is it's a bycatch, and then OPA, which we actually do eat. Two species of OPA found over half of them had some form of debris in their stomach.
Oh, boy.
Yes.
Well, I guess, you know, with any kind of study like this, you come to the end of a study and with a wish list of what you wish would be further investigated.
Yes.
What's yours?
Well, it's a big topic, we'd like to do some tests into whether or not, you know, toxicity is transferred through the ingestion of these anthropogenic or man-made materials.
Uh-huh.
But that's going to require, you know, a lot of funding and new samples, and it'll be down the road.
Well, there's certainly a lot of interest in it, but interest and funding are two different things, yeah?
Correct, yes.
So in the scientific community, how do you get the word out about something like this that really, you know, almost demands further study?
We just try to talk to as many people as we can, not just news outlets like you guys, but, you know, friends and family. And it's just like you guys are doing here. It's a conversation about human impact on the ocean.
Yeah.
And it's a big topic, so...
Well, it's a big topic that maybe you would think would be more, you know, that there'd be more studies in place about it, right?
Yes.
What was your motivation to get going on this?
Well, I'm working on a larger project that's looking at kind of how energy is moved around in the open ocean through animals. So who eats who, where does energy go, and how does it build at different levels in the ocean? And so what we were doing was... basically doing a diet study of these different species,
mm-hmm.
And that's to help properly manage everything that's below them as well. And this was kind of an incidental finding along the way. This was a 6-year diet study of these 10 different species.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a bit of a surprise finding.
Well, I wish you luck in your further researches, and it really sounds as if you're onto something that's really worthy of study. And
Thanks
very much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Anela Choi is a UH Manoa graduate student who's the lead author of a study of marine debris that was recently published in the scientific journal Marine Ecology Progress series. Details are on our HPR2.org website.
Don't go near the water. Don't you think it's sad? What's happened to the water? Our water's going bad.
HPR listeners who are also station members share in the station's vision to build this network into a truly statewide service. Mahalo to Mayangi Yashioka of Honolulu, Joyce Larkin of Keau, and Karen Koga of Honolulu for their membership gifts. A growing number of members are choosing lifetime membership as their preferred way to support HPR now and into the future. Lifetime members pledge a monthly gift of $5 or more. That continues until you tell us otherwise. To become a lifetime member today, call 955-8821 during regular business hours or just follow the support link at hpr2.org. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. It's 827. This is The Conversation on HPR Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for today's programming comes from Waikiki Aquarium, announcing the Volunteer Docent Training Program to help educate school children about our ocean ecosystem. The next training begins September 3rd. WAquarium.org or 440-9020.
Now on to the highest level of public education in Hawaii, the university system. The UH is researching a vice president of research, but is it possible to overlook defense industry ties with prime candidates? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So we have five finalists who are being scrutinized to head the University of Hawaii's research efforts. That's a very powerful position with that $1 billion per year research industry by the state initiative. That's a lot of money, a lot of power, and we seem to know kind of little about the people who may be vying for it.
Well, three of the five candidates have raised concerns among some students and faculty, and their concerns, as you indicated at the top, is that they have very close ties to the defense industry. The concern, say these faculty and students, is that, you know, you might sacrifice education for, if you will, lucrative, classified, defense-related projects. That's the big concern there. UH will not comment directly on this. There are personnel rules involved with hires. We can tell you, however, that the resumes, the CVs, are posted online in UH Manoa, and the candidates have also made public presentations that were filmed as well. So there is some information available about these candidates.
Is the fact that the UH recently extended the contract for that Navy lab without public input also helping disperse some of this along and maybe getting people a little bit more tweaked about it or focused on it?
I think so. You're talking about the Navy Research Lab. It's located within UH facilities. There wasn't any public input, but as you say, they went ahead and extended the contract. We can tell you that a university spokesperson told us the candidates for the VP job come from diverse backgrounds and experience. UH wants to broaden its research portfolio. They want to help diversify the economy. Research would help along those lines. The concern, of course, is that you're sneaking military initiatives, military plans into university, a public university, mind you, not a private university, but the mission of a public university. So that is the big concern here. You can read Aaliyah Wong's story on our website at civilbeat.com. It's great stuff, helping us understand what's going on at UH.
Right, and trying to draw that line of where education ends and help and support in research dollars for the university begins. And I guess we're not going to have an answer anytime soon until they finally decide on someone.
We'll be following it. Don't worry.
I know. We'll talk about it, won't we? Thanks, Chad.
We will. Okay, Beth. Bye-bye.
Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. Kathy's on the line, and lots of links between what you eat and how you feel, huh, Kathy?
You got it. We're going to talk about how, depending on what medical conditions you have, some of the foods that you might be eating every day might be making you feel a lot worse than you need to.
You know, it's often seems strange to me that it seems historically as if it took a fairly long time for nutrition and health to be linked in medicine. I mean, is that an accurate perception?
Well, it did, and in some cases it still does. You know, when we talk to people, for example, who have gout and they just can't give up their shellfish or their alcohol or their meat, you know, these are foods that they know can cause symptoms, and it's an obvious connection. But sometimes there's foods we eat that don't make you have that obvious connection, and you don't even realize that you might be sensitive to gluten or you might have a problem eating certain types of lactose. And so we're going to talk about what are those subtle symptoms so that people really understand how what they eat makes that direct connection with how you feel.
So there might be something that we're just plain overlooking because the symptoms aren't overt and immediately related to consumption, huh?
Or we learn to live with the symptoms and think it's normal.
Yeah. Well, the gout is a good example because that's pretty clearly linked to diet, isn't it?
Well, it can be, you know, and gout's an easy example, but even something like diabetes, people may have subtle signs of certain foods that help them to manage their sugars better, but they're not sure how to interpret those signs or even if that's really what they're feeling. So we're going to talk with a nutritionist today about how do you know if what you're eating is actually making you feel bad and what you can do about it.
Well, thanks, Kathy. That's valuable stuff to get sorted out. And that's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. This is The Conversation on HPR2. If you've been out on the roads today, well, then you know that back to school means back to traffic. For many teachers, a lot of them new to their schools, it also means making their way to some stifling classrooms. And that has more than one teacher hot under the collar. We called one we speak with periodically, Corey Rosenley, and asked if teachers are facing different realities this school year.
Well, I think for a lot of teachers, you know, starting the new evaluation process, you know, there's a lot of nervousness about how that's going to impact their teaching and the learning in the classroom. One of the big new things for my own school is that we have close to 30 new teachers. You know, even for some positions, there are no teachers right now. So it's very possible that if you're a parent right now, your child will go to a classroom that the person they have won't be a teacher, but they won't even know that.
And they won't know that because parents will not have been advised that their kids don't have a permanent teacher?
Right. I mean, if someone's in the room, it's a teacher. You know, we don't know if that person has an education degree, if they're emergency hire, you know, what their qualifications are. As long as you have an adult in the front of the room, they're called teacher. But, you know, that's very unfair. And so a lot of times every year we have this high turnover rate, and every year we have, you know, new teachers coming in, but sometimes we just don't have enough bodies to fill the classroom. And so schools are going out and trying to find anyone they can get to be in the classroom. But long-term-wise, you know, that, think about how that impacts education.
As you start this year, too, we're coming out of a week where we had very high humidity and heat of a different nature. And you're in classrooms that don't have AC. But if you're lucky, you get a fan or maybe a couple of them and have to talk over all of them. How is that impacting your kids?
Well, I want to give a situation of this one teacher, brand new teacher. She walks into her classroom. Her room has four cinder block walls. There is no cross ventilation. Basically, two walls have slits of windows at the top. That's it. And one of those windows, basically, the sun comes in, so they have to close it. She has no fans, nothing. You know, and they're going to put 30, 40 kids into her classroom, and basically what we've created is a cinder block oven. And if you've ever been in a classroom like that, it's just so impossible to teach because the kids come in, especially after lunch, it's hot, and the heat is so bad that they can't focus on learning.
And many studies show that kids have to be in a temperature of about, you know, 72 degrees optimally, but certainly nothing more than about 75 or 76 if you want them to pay attention. Yet these classrooms are 80 degrees, 85 degrees, or higher.
As a teacher, it angered me when I was in a classroom like that. You wouldn't think that in Minnesota they wouldn't heat their rooms, or Arizona they wouldn't air condition their rooms. Guam passed a law saying that classrooms had to be cooler than 78 degrees or they had to be air conditioned. In Hawaii, we haven't done that. You know, and it angers me so much that they would put a child into a room like that, 100 degrees, and it's okay. I mean, if you were to put a child, even if you left the windows open in a car and it was 100 degrees, they would arrest the parent. But parents are going to be dropping off their kids to school, and they're going to put them in a 100-degree classroom, and not just by themselves, but with 40 other kids, and that's okay. And it can't be that way. The law has to change on that.
Why do you think that, knowing this, parents obviously de facto say it's okay because they drop off their kids just because they have to?
Well, we get used to the normal even if we sometimes think it's wrong. And only when things change does it matter to us. Take, for example, what if, say, for example, Campbell High School already had air conditioning, and they said, okay, we want to save money, so we're taking away the air conditioning, but this means that your children will have to be in 100-degree rooms. Then people would get upset. They say, that's unfair. You know, they would do something about it. But it's almost sort of like we may be angry at the status quo, but we almost feel like we can't do anything about it.
So how do we do something about it?
Well, in 2008, Campbell High School, we marched on the Capitol asking for air conditioning. And the recession hit a year later, and they were thinking about firing teachers. You know, now that the government has a surplus, teachers from Campbell and hopefully teachers from schools across the state, you know, this year we're going to push for a bill to mandate air conditioning. And Representative Takai in 2011 actually proposed a bill that said that within 5 years, all schools in Hawaii will have air conditioning. You know, and Guam passed that law. That's what we need to do in Hawaii.
Meanwhile, yeah. Corey, what are you going to do this year, next year, and whatever years it takes in between introducing a bill, getting it passed, and getting that AC in the school? Because I can hear the frustration in your voice, and it seems like, you know, we still have a whole generation of kids that are going to go through their entire high school career not having anything but hot classrooms.
My fear is not that we won't have it in 5 years, but my fear is in 10, 20 years we still won't have it. We're talking about multiple generations going out. If you wanted to ask me, yes, I would want the air conditioning in next week. No kid, I mean, the two parts of our conversation is there will be kids that are going into rooms that are 100 degrees with a teacher that has no experience, and we can't call that an equal education. We can't call that a fair education. When those kids drop out or they're unprepared for college and we're surprised, you know, this is the current situation, and those things must change.
Is there anything that could be done, not quite in the order of a swamp cooler, because for reasons that have to do, I guess, with condensation, we don't use swamp coolers, but something other than AC, some sort of ceiling fan that pulls the heat out of the classroom? Would that be something that would work at your school?
I used to have a classroom where I had 11 fans. And many of those fans I had to purchase on my own. I just built it up over the years. And what the thing is realize you think 11 fans would actually do it, and it doesn't. The reason why is, number one, try to imagine competing with 11 fans. You're trying to teach a class, and I have one fan that sounds like an airplane taking off.
Right, you know, and I understand that, because you have them localized in the room. But is there any way of being able to do something with the ceiling of the classroom to be able to allow that air to flow up and out in ways that, you know, swamp coolers help in certain states where that's appropriate?
You know, it hasn't been in my experience. I've had ceiling fans at it before, but ceiling fans really don't deal with the humidity. And I know the hard part is we want a solution now, but the reality is I think that having gone through ceiling fans, 11 fans, you know, doing everything before, that reality is that, you know, when they've tried these experiments in the past, that air conditioning does seem to be the one way. You know, I just wish that, the possibility is, you know, my dream would be even to have like a wall unit. You know, a wall unit is a lot cheaper than some of these large construction projects. But right now, there are rules against putting wall units into a classroom.
And with those tiny itty-bitty windows at the very top of the wall, they might not fit in them anyway.
They may not, and not all classrooms have that ability. But more than not, it does. It's interesting that if you go down to, say, the Department of Education or the Board of Education or Legislature, they do have their air conditioning, but our students don't. And that makes a difference. You know, if we do value, you know, the next generation, we do value our students, then hopefully, I mean, wouldn't it be nice if this year the legislature would say, okay, we agree. We need to start appropriating funds for this. We do plan on fighting this year. I think that we finally had enough and we want to do something. And, you know, rather than live on a negative note, I want to say to those parents out there or those legislators out there that let's make this year the year we change this.
Well, you have an ability to make a change. This may be the year that galvanizes the kind of support that you once had in 2008. We're going to hope for the best for you and hopefully for some cooler weather, too. Thanks, Corey.
Thank you.
Corey Rosenlee is a 15-year nationally certified social studies teacher from Campbell High School. He is one of the organizers of the Hawaii Teachers Work to the Rules movement. And although today is a little cooler, as soon as the temperature rises, he and his students will compete with the heat to teach and learn.
Support for today's programming comes from the Joy of Sake, a celebration featuring more than 380 sake entries and sake-friendly appetizers from 16 restaurants, August 16th at the Hawaii Convention Center. joyofsake.com.
Aloha, I'm Dave Lawrence, and this is Stargazer, our weekly guide of what to look for in our island skies. We've got Sean Lotch from the Emilo Astronomy Center in Hilo on the line. He's our official conduit to the research community atop Mauna Kea. Hey, Sean, aloha. What are some of the things we'll be looking for in our week of stargazing?
Aloha, Dave. Greetings from Mauna Kea. New moon is tomorrow, so look for a thin crescent moon starting on Tuesday, low in the western sky at sunset. Friday it will be 5 degrees above Venus in the western sky. Saturn is in the southwestern sky at sunset, while Mercury, Mars, and Jupiter are in the eastern sky at sunrise. And Jupiter's getting higher. It is worth taking a look for those Galilean moons once again.
Ah, they're always fun to look for. What's going on in terms of the ISS X-37B?
Tomorrow morning, look for the International Space Station from 4:18 to 4:24 a.m., moving from north to east. Then that night, look for it from 7:15 to 7:22 p.m., moving from west to northeast. And Sunday morning, you can see the Tiangong 1 from 5:23 to 5:28 a.m., moving from southwest to northeast.
What do we have in terms of, you said there was a discovery you wanted to share?
Yeah, the Hubble Space Telescope has deduced the actual color of a planet orbiting another star, which is roughly 63 light-years away. The planet is called HD 189733b, and its color is cobalt blue. Now, if seen directly, this planet would look like a pale blue dot. And although the planet resembles Earth in terms of color, it is not an Earth-like world. Instead, the daytime temperature is nearly 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
And it possibly rains glass in howling 4,500-mile-an-hour winds. The cobalt blue color comes from clouds laced with silicate particles. Now, you might remember that recently the Cassini spacecraft from Saturn took an image of the Earth, and it showed it as a pale blue dot as well. So while Earth and this exoplanet might look similar, they are strikingly different.
No raining glass, thankfully.
Very much so.
We appreciate the heads up. Thank you, Sean.
Mahalo for having me, Dave.
You're quite welcome. Sean Lotch, Emilo Astronomy Center on the Big Island, and I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next time here for Stargazer.
Now back to Earth and a neighborhood school. This morning we asked you, whatever happened to Benjamin Parker High School in Kaneohe? It was built on land donated to the Territory of Hawaii in 1925 by Reverend Benjamin Parker's son Henry, who had been a pastor at Kauai Hau Church. When Parker Elementary and Intermediate opened its doors in 1927, on the windward side, it served 300 first through eighth graders from Waimanalo to Waihole, Waikane. And as the territorial population grew, ninth grade was added in 1935, kindergarten in 1937, and 10th through 12th grades from 1938 to 1940, respectively. For a decade, Benjamin Parker High School conferred diplomas upon nearly 1,000 graduates. But after the class of 1950, it was all POW. The reason? Well, that's because 1951 was the year that James B. Castle, Oahu's first dedicated Windward Public High School, opened its doors. Hello, Castle Knights. Farewell, Benjamin Parkerites. That's our backyard quiz. If you've got one, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
As Benjamin Parker High School was growing, so was an activity many of its students enjoyed, swing dancing. It may be rooted in the pre-Second World War past, when Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller were the rock stars of their day, but it has never really died out. If anything, it seems to be expanding these days with styles within a style. East Coast, West Coast, Lindy Hop, Blues, Charleston, Balboa. It's partner dancing for those who crave a little human contact, and it's a genuine skill with lots to learn. It's been part of Mark Hammer's world for quite some time, and we asked him to help us sort out some of these different languages of movement. He's the president emeritus of Swing Maui, and he's on the phone with us now. Good morning, Mark.
Aloha, good morning. How can I help you?
Well, I'm wondering what it is that draws people to swing dancing. I'm going to guess that it has something to do with dancing with somebody. Is that right?
Yes, I believe it's primarily social dancing versus performance dancing or competition dancing like you will see on television. It's about going out, socializing, and listening to some good music and having some, you know, meaningful contact in a musical or rhythmic way with another person.
What kind of music is favored for swing dancing?
That depends on whether or not you are DJing or having live music.
Mm-hmm.
Some people prefer DJ music, in which case you'll have a lot of your big band sounds from the 30s and 40s. However, it's very difficult to put a 37-piece orchestra into a little nightclub here in Kihei.
Yes, it is.
So the 3-, 4-, and 5-piece combos that play live, and if you go out for live music, you'll be hearing more of what I call affectionately called the lounge music, which is swing music that has been written for or arranged for a smaller combo. Or you'll hear blues-based music, and that's pretty much what's played, and it depends, like I said, it depends upon which way you go.
Now, how do you define blues-based music? Because that can go in any number of different directions, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Blues is one of the most pervasive genres I've ever seen. It's also one of the most versatile. I think every serious recording artist has at some point in time in their career played and or recorded blues. It goes all the way back to, as you said, the pre-war era with Bessie Smith, T-Bone Walker, Lead Belly, Memphis Slim, those type of people, through the people that were our contemporaries like Eric Clapton, B.B. King, Stevie Ray Vaughan, to very, very contemporary like Wynton Marsalis, Kev Moe, Brother Yusef.
That's quite a range of people you talked about, from Bessie Smith to Wynton Marsalis, for one thing. That's quite a stretch. And a lot of the music that I've seen cited as blues music for blues dancing kind of veers into jazz, Ellington, Nina Simone, people like that. That's not strictly the kind of Muddy Waters Chicago blues that some people might think, yeah?
Again, everybody plays blues. Everybody has played blues, including the big band swing orchestras will play blues. Blues is a particular rhythm, a particular beat.
Yeah, I know.
It grew up alongside of, or it, blues dancing, I should say, developed alongside of swing dancing. The dancers that would dance in the Cotton Club and of the 1930s in Harlem would then go out to the juke joints and dance blues. Lindy Hop at the Savoy Ballroom with their one block long dance floor, and then blues after hours. So, yeah, it's incredibly varied, and almost everybody plays it.
Well, what are the techniques? Say while we're talking about blues dancing, what are the techniques sort of specific to that? How do you move to that?
Like all dance, it's rhythm-based.
I'm thinking, for example, a typical blues rhythm is what we call the shuffle, right?
Correct.
So it's 3/4, in a sense, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. But it's yet you're counting four, but you're doing 3/4. Is that something that the dancer would keep in mind?
He would if the music told him to do so. Mm-hmm. Remember, the dance is as varied as the music is. If the music is 3/4, sure. If the music takes a little bit different style, then you would modify the dance rhythm according to the music. There are three partners in a partner dance. There's the lead, the follow, and the music. Mm-hmm. And it's as much about connection to the music as it is about connection to each other.
That's a good point, the three partners. So when you teach it, do you sort of spend some time on helping the dancers kind of pick out what the dominant beats are and kind of teaching them to count the way a musician might learn to count?
Absolutely. We teach both rhythm and the variations on rhythms and the different types of rhythms. And we also teach what we call phrasing. Whereas a musician would count in measures of 4 beats in 4/4 time, a dancer generally, usually counts in 2 measures or 8 beats.
Okay.
A lot of that is simply because it takes 8 beats of music to complete, you know, a move.
Well, you get a more fluid motion when you stretch it out over more beats. Otherwise, I mean, if you just went 4 beats, it would get kind of herky-jerky, wouldn't it?
It does, and it also gets a little boring.
Sure.
So you add more variety when you stretch it out over 8 beats, and we call that a phrase.
So you're really kind of thinking like a musician in order to to dance to this music. It sounds, it kind of adds a layer of complexity to it, makes it sound pretty interesting, Mark.
Indeed, you are. And you do end up with a bit of a musical education. Even you may not need to be a musician. You don't need to be a musician to dance to it, but you will learn a lot about music.
Well, great. Thank you very much for talking with us this morning.
You're most welcome.
Mark Hammer is the President Emeritus of Swing Maui, which offers classes in East Coast, West Coast, Lindy Hop, Blues, Charleston, and Balboa, among other styles. And you can find out more at hpr2.org.
Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Travasa Hana, an experiential resort on Maui, whose partnership with Mokulele Airlines and Enterprise makes getting to Hana convenient, with daily flights to Hana and one-way rental cars. Travasa.com/Hana.
When you watch a breathtaking performance by an athlete, do you ever wonder how much of that talent is genetic and how much comes from hard work and practice? On the next Fresh Air, journalist David Epstein tells us what scientists are learning about genetics and athletic performance. Some of it will surprise you. His book is The Sports Gene. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
This half hour, we talked with a teacher about the heat in his classroom, which is getting him steamed. I can't imagine coming into a classroom that's 88 degrees or 100 degrees and expecting anything other than everyone to fall asleep and wait it out.
And that's what happens, and we've certainly seen the result. I loved his description of trying to make himself heard over the sound of 11 fans. And also comparing his facility to a facility like the Capitol Building, where if you're on the basement floor of the Capitol Building any given day, it's cold enough to see your breath down there.
And you need a sweater. If only they could bottle that and move it elsewhere. But
exactly.
Maybe the legislators should try to be in 80-degree temperature, 90-degree temperature, and see how much work they get done, too.
The hearings would be a lot shorter. I know that.
Well, that's going to do it for us today with time. We will be back with you tomorrow. After one unsuccessful attempt, Honolulu police plan to try again, as you know, to use cameras capable of reading multiple license plates a second. And you can bet the ACLU doesn't like it one bit. We're going to hear why your privacy could be compromised.
And we'll find out what you can learn from a summer-long immersion in comedy improv.
You can talk back to your radio on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or get me at Because HPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, our links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkamp.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation.